Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The railways changed vacationing in America. So did cars and interstate highways and mass air travel. The latest change is not a vehicle, but a little bit of technology that allows people to share, they say, almost everything, including their houses. How's the old resort doing, the old rental economy in the age of the sharing economy? We'll ask this hour on Point, vacationing in the age of Airbnb. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you changed how you find a place to stay, the way you vacation? Have you moved into new vacation territory with peer-to-peer, with the shared economy? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from New York is Pauline Frommer. She is editorial director for the Frommer Guidebooks. Pauline, it's great to have you back on Point.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you.
So here we are. It's summertime. People are vacationing, and I don't think the world has been turned upside down by Airbnb and its cousins. But can you see its fingerprints out there in the world, in the way people rent out their homes or apartments, in the way people find a place to stay?
Sure, absolutely. A lot of people who rent out either part of their apartments or their entire apartments found it kept them afloat during the recession. I stayed with a social worker in Sacramento who was out of work for a full year, and she said if she hadn't been able to rent her extra room, she would have had to move out of her house. It kept her afloat. But it's also great for vacationers. A lot of people are traveling this way. There was a recent study by one of the tourism departments at a major university that showed that in the markets where Airbnb is strong, the budget hotels are getting bitten into their business by about 5%.
That's interesting. I mean, we should say, just make very clear for people who have not used it or haven't checked it out, it's pretty famous at this point and controversial in some areas, but this is the online service where basically anybody can put up a sofa or a room or an apartment or their whole house and offer it to a visitor at a price. They agree on the price and off they go. You're not in a hotel. You're in someone's place.
Yeah, and it's actually a very personal way to travel. I've met great people. I've had some wacky experiences. I once stayed in the home of an acupuncturist, and it was only $35 a night, so I should have known something was funky.
Okay.
I was sleeping on the acupuncture table.
He threw
a sheet over it. But we also had a great talk about Tolkien, and he told me some great local restaurants to go to, and it turned out to be a lot of fun. In Gdansk, Poland, I went with my 8-year-old daughter. It was about 2 years ago then. And our host, who rented us the entire apartment, filled it with toys for my daughter. So you can have really, really great experiences. I've stayed in gorgeous places and less gorgeous places, but always clean and always friendly.
I guess there's some degree of luck if it's always clean, because it's not guaranteed, but then it's not guaranteed in a hotel or motel either.
Well, yeah, some luck, but you know, the people who stay in these places review the places on Airbnb, and they review you as a guest, so you've got to be on your best behavior. Actually, when I get depressed, I sometimes go and read my Airbnb reviews, because people like me.
Guest.
They think I'm a good guest. Yeah.
We were just thinking about the way this changes, let's say, vacation destinations, both for the visitors and for those who are already there. You know, you've got some destinations, be it in the, you know, hills or on a lake or on a beach, where people have rented the same house year after year after year from the same landlord or landlady, renter. And now they've got maybe competition from all over the world. Maybe the house that they rented on the Outer Banks or you name it is now being rented by somebody from Germany or Japan who snacked it up on Airbnb.
Yeah, I hear that it's actually caused prices to go down in some parts because so many people have entered the rental market because it's so much easier now to rent your place. Mm-hmm. It's also making the hotels pretty nervous. There are certain cities like New York, like Paris, like Las Vegas, there are others where it's illegal to rent an apartment for less than 30 days. They say it's because it's taking rentable apartments out of the housing stock and causing all of the prices to rise. That is the reason given. But I think that probably the hotel lobby, which is very, very powerful in these cities, has something to do with it too.
I wonder if it changes the flow of travelers, vacationers, and more. I mean, there was a time when, of necessity, most people who visited anywhere in the world, whether it was around the corner or it was Barcelona or Paris, they went to hotels, they went to hostels. Those tended to be clustered in certain areas of town. They created communities in their own lobbies and reception areas. Now people are scattered all over cities. I wonder if it changes the flow of traveling and with that the experience.
I think so. I mean, in certain municipalities, hotels can only exist in areas that are zoned commercial. So often these are places that shut down at night, that, you know, don't have restaurants that the locals go to. But with the sharing economy, which goes beyond Airbnb, there's mm-hmm. another company called Wimdu, there's VRBO, there's HomeAway, there's dozens of them. With these types of organizations, travelers are getting into the real residential areas and seeing what the life of the place is like. It's a very different travel experience.
A change in the way we do it and where it takes us, maybe. Pauline Frommer is with us from Frommer Guidebooks, editorial director there in New York. We're going to hear in a moment from a reporter who's looked very closely at how it's working out in one very popular city, San Francisco. Pauline, let me go to our callers as well. Michelle in Columbia, South Carolina. Michelle, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What are you finding in your travel, your vacations?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am a huge fan of Airbnb. Prior to this year, I was very much a hotel girl. I had changed that, you know, I preferred to stay at and was pretty loyal to.
Mm-hmm.
But since finding out about Airbnb, I've used the service at least three or four times now, anywhere from, you know, staying in someone's garage apartment to an entire house, to staying there while they are still there and they're hosting and things like that. And I just find it to be a much more satisfying experience, particularly for long-term visits anywhere that I happen to go. And I've actually returned to some of the places that I found on Airbnb.
Michelle, is this business travel or are you vacationing when you do this?
Both. Absolutely both. The ones that I tend to return to are for business, but my husband and I are taking a trip to Ireland for business and pleasure coming in September, and we found a great little apartment in Dublin down on the river, and we're going to be in the middle of everything. And the difference in price between Airbnb, what we found in the hotels there, is just astronomical. It's good for our pocket.
So I get the money side of it. You say it's more satisfying. What do you mean exactly by that, Michelle?
Just the notion of being somewhere where you have everything that you would have at home. So, you know, there are some hotels who offer full kitchens, but the majority of the places that I've stayed on Airbnb, because they are people's homes, have everything down to the ironing board and things like that. So you're really not having to go downstairs to the front desk to ask for everything. It's just right there.
What about the old hotel amenities, the fluffy robe if it's there, and room service, and, I don't know, the mini bar? Do you ever miss that stuff?
Well, yeah, to some extent. There are a lot of places I enjoy a good pool, and so some of the places that I've stayed haven't had that. But for me, just in terms of the amount of money that you save or can save on Airbnb, it makes letting go of some of those amenities a little bit easier.
Michelle, it's really interesting to hear how your own travel has changed. Pauline Frommer, there's direct testimony. She says, you know, she's sort of over hotels. But I'm looking at hotel numbers. You said budget numbers are down a bit, but overall, it looks like hotels are not doing too badly in the U.S. anyway.
Oh, yeah. Actually, hotels are doing much better than they were a couple of years ago. Occupancy rates are up across the boards, and luxury hotels really have not yet felt any impact from the sharing economy. Whether that will change remains to be seen. There are certain companies that now are rewarding their employees if they spend less when they travel. I hear that Google, for one, if you spend less than your allotted budget, apparently you get some credits back and you can use those for an upgrade on your next business flight, or maybe the money can go to charity. And more businesses are doing this, saying book your own travel, see if you can save money, and you'll save the company money.
Do you think
if
that's going to push people onto acupuncture beds and third sofas?
I don't know. I don't know if everybody is as crazy as I am in terms of what you'll do. But, you know, when you look at the fact that you can sometimes get a complete apartment on one of these sites for $80 a night, as opposed to $200 a night for a hotel room, there's no trade-off in staying in the apartment. You're getting just as good a deal.
And then Michelle says she likes the way going into apartments and homes puts her in the thick of life wherever she's traveling.
Yeah, I've met wonderful people doing this. I mean, I'm on the road so much so that I start to get tired of impersonal hotel rooms and people who are paid to be nice to me. Not that I'm not paying my hosts through Airbnb and other services, but I've had hosts drive me to their favorite places for dinner, invite me to a party they're having upstairs, you know, greet me with wine and cheese. It's just a very personal way to travel.
Of course, I'm sure there are still people as well who say, I want that hotel experience. I want that lobby, and I want that pool, and I want that nice restaurant up on top if it's there. And
you have to be prepared to chat. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't just say, they're not a hotel clerk. This is their home. So if you really want something that's impersonal, Airbnb ain't for you, because you're going to have to chat with this person.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about summer vacations, vacationing in the age of Airbnb, travel and vacationing in the so-called sharing or peer-to-peer economy. Pauline Frommer joins us from New York, editorial director for the Frommer Guidebooks, pays a lot of attention to the way people are traveling and vacationing. Yesterday on CBS This Morning, host Gail King asked Marriott hotel chain CEO Arne Sorensen if he was worried about the rise of Airbnb.
I think Airbnb is a very interesting experiment and something that is really fun to watch. It offers mostly not.
No.
But time will tell, though. I mean, they've obviously built a great presence in a short period of time. They do some things that we can't do. So something like 10% of their business, for example, in New York would be people trying out neighborhoods, people moving to Manhattan, thinking, all right, I want to live in the East Village for a while, or I want to live on the Upper West Side for a while and see what it feels like. So let me see if I can get an apartment. Mm-hmm. That's not something you would use a hotel for.
The CEO of Marriott with his eye on Airbnb, people trying out neighborhoods. But of course, it's more than that. People traveling and vacationing. Here's a co-founder of Airbnb, now CEO, Brian Chesky. He was speaking in June at the Aspen Ideas Festival. He said that cities, as we know them, are changing under the influence of this new way.
I think we're going to go back to the village. Cities will become communities again. I'm not saying they're not communities now, but I think that they'll have this real sense of village. And then everything will be small. So you're not going to have big chain restaurants. We're starting to see you have farmers markets and small restaurants and food trucks. But pretty soon, restaurants will be in people's living rooms. And everything will get smaller and smaller and smaller. And more people will be able to participate in this economy.
Restaurants will be in people's living rooms, hotels in their third bedroom. Some people will love that. Some may not. Pauline Frommer, stand by. New York. We'll go to San Francisco in just a moment. First, Emmy is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Emmy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So we are a family of four with two small children. And one thing that Airbnb and VRBO and HomeAway and sites like Kid&Co, all these websites are individuals who are offering their home. And what I think is really nice is when I want to cook a meal, I don't have to go and buy condiments, or I have to think about, you know, where am I going to get basil or cinnamon for French toast. You know, it's actually there's cinnamon in the cupboard, you know, in the cabinet. And that's really nice. And also we look for places that have families have children, young children, and it's great because then they're like, your kids can use my kids' toys, and that's
wonderful. And no matter how many kids clubs you have at a Marriott or whatever. And I like a really modern boutique sensibility, and I actually can get that and not pay up the wazoo for it. So that's what I really like about Airbnb and those types of websites.
Sounds like you're a convert, Emmy. I appreciate your call. Pauline, boy, talk about the difference. There it is right there. I mean, you're not in a hotel. You're in someone's home. I mean, you're using their condiments. When you're in their basil and their cinnamon. You're in their ketchup bottle. That's intimacy.
Yeah, that's part of the fun. And you know how the co-founder of Airbnb was talking about dining in someone's living room? That's happening, too. There are these things called pirate restaurants that are popping up all across the U.S. It's a movement that arguably started in San Francisco. It's totally illegal because if you're going to charge people for food, the Board of Health wants to make sure you're doing it right. But people are doing this. There's all kinds of ways the sharing economy is totally reshaping the travel experience.
Not everybody is agreeing that it's such a great bargain. Here, Helen writes to us on Facebook, says, I haven't used it because everywhere I've looked, the prices for Airbnb are way too close to hotel prices. If I'm going to forego the reliability and regulation of a hotel, it will be at a substantial savings. It can be close. Let me get a call from Cleveland, Ohio. Arthur, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, sir.
Hi.
I used a system called FlipKey, and I was staying in Louisville last week, the July 4th week.
Okay.
And I got a townhouse, 3 bedrooms, and it was only $800. So it was interesting. So now I'm hearing about this system, so I'd like to try that too. But that experience was very nice.
FlipKey for a 3-bedroom townhouse for the whole weekend, $800, and you can put a lot of people in a townhouse with
bedrooms.
Arthur, was it better than a hotel? Were you missing the amenities of a hotel or resort?
Well, when you say amenities, what else could you ask for? A full kitchen? They did have a common area. They didn't have a pool in the townhouse area, so all of it was bare. And like you said, it was very intimate because the owner told us about restaurants, even did take us to a restaurant across the street. So that was very nice.
Arthur, traveling with FlipKey out of Cleveland down not so far, but for a great weekend there. Arthur, I appreciate your call. Pauline, here's another. Eric says, I started staying Airbnb. I've never looked back. It gives you the ability to have a true home away from home. Many of the places you can stay, especially when considering a bigger city, are away from the touristy areas and give you a chance to really experience what the area is like. It's true. You won't necessarily be in the tour. You could choose that, but you won't necessarily be on the tourist trail, Pauline.
Well, most people don't live on the tourist trail, and they are renting their homes, so no, you won't be. I know that a lot of people doing this for the first time are nervous about the money aspect of it. I'm going to hand my money over to a stranger. How do I know they're not just going to run off with it? Well, with these sites that we've been mentioning, Airbnb, Wimdu, FlipKey, which is owned by TripAdvisor, you give the money to that large organization, and it's only released after your first night's stay. So there is it is fairly safe in that way.
You've got all kinds of reactions here. Here's Chiron from New Orleans. Says, Tom, it's all not roses. Here in New Orleans, we residents are watching Airbnb destroy our quality of life. Our residential neighborhoods are being turned into giant hotels for tourists. Renters are being kicked out. Properties bought by out-of-towners to use as illegal commercial businesses. They don't pay taxes, get inspected, or have proper insurance. Ironically, your guest cites tourists getting into residential neighborhoods as a plus. We residents in New Orleans, Chiron says, hate it. Not so popular there, Pauline.
Yeah, that's the big argument against these types of websites, that it turns residential housing into illegal hotels. But on the other hand, you have cities like New York where the average hotel room is $250 a night. It's the most expensive city for visitors in this hemisphere. There just aren't enough hotel rooms. And I know a lot of artists who will move out of their apartment for a night or two so they can make the rent. So there are two sides of it. I mean, I have a neighbor who sometimes screams at night. I would prefer to have a visitor next door many nights.
Of course, it's not legal in New York, though, for most of the...
It's not legal. No. It's legal if you're staying with somebody who's still in the apartment. If it's a B&B situation, not a rental.
You can be an outlaw in New York. Let's look at San Francisco with Carolyn Said, business reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, covers the sharing economy in San Francisco, home of a lot of this evolution. Carolyn Said in San Francisco, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So what is, first of all, the state of legality and what's legal and what's not when it comes to this kind of Airbnb rental in San Francisco these days?
Well, Airbnb is absolutely illegal in its hometown of San Francisco. We have a prohibition against any residential rentals of less than 30 days. However, that is a very loosely enforced prohibition, and in fact, we have more than 5,000 Airbnb listings, so there's a lot of irony there. Right now, the president of our Board of Supervisors has spent 2 years working on a plan to legalize and regulate Airbnb, and it's just recently been introduced, and it's going to be thrashed out over the next few months.
You've been writing about many faces of this. How popular is this now with tourists, vacationers coming to San Francisco? It's a big destination town.
Well, you know, so far the show has focused on that aspect. It is popular with tourists. That's rosy and good. However, there is the big aspect on the other side. It's not, as the person from New Orleans said, it's not always popular with residents, and that is the controversy. There are a lot of neighbors and neighborhoods who don't want their residential neighborhood to become commercial. On the other hand, there might be merchants in those neighborhoods who are happy to have that extra business coming to them. So, you know, there's a lot on both sides here. There are regulatory issues, there's social issues, there's the big tax issue that Airbnb has not been paying the hotel tax. That is something they say they're going to start doing this summer, 2 years after our city treasurer said that they should be remitting that tax. And then there's health and safety issues. So, yes, it's very popular with tourists, but it's somewhat less popular in many of the places where it operates, including here in its hometown.
Is it cutting into the hotel, motel industry, or is it still at the fringes?
At this point, I don't think so. Here in San Francisco, you know, we're a top tourist destination. Tourism and travel is our biggest economic engine, and yet we have hardly built any new hotel rooms in the past 10 years. So we have the highest hotel occupancy rate in the country, so Airbnb doesn't really make a dent in that. That study that Pauline cited earlier about it affecting perhaps 5% margin of smaller hotels, that was a very small study in Texas, which I don't know how... you know, significant of a market that is. However, if Airbnb continues on its, you know, really fast-paced growth, it will start to affect hotels. And I think where we would see that effect is the next time we have an economic downturn. Right now, things are booming, people are traveling, the economy is good. The next time things retrench and people cut back on travel, they will be looking for more budget options. And so then they would increasingly, if they are traveling, opt for something like Airbnb over a hotel, not just because of the savings. Airbnb here is actually often fairly close in price to hotels. I did a study of the Airbnb listings here, and you know they averaged around $200 a night, which is not that, and the hotel averages $229 a night here. Mm-hmm. But you can also save money because you can cook.
So, yeah. What about the range of accommodations, Carolyn? I'm looking at one here that you write about, $6,000 a night, $7,000 a night for this is a four-story French chateau in beautiful Pacific Heights in San Francisco. But that's quite the range from, I don't know, the sofa surfing to $7,000 a night.
Right. Well, Airbnb started as basically sofa surfing. It's the reason it's called Airbnb is it started as air mattresses on the floor of its founder's apartment here in San Francisco. But it's really come quite a bit from that. There are still a sliver of the listings are shared rooms, and some of them are even shared living rooms. But more and more, the majority of the listings, about two-thirds of the listings, are entire homes or apartments where the owner is not in residence. They're either, you know, away on vacation, they're doing something else, it's their second home they're renting, or we hear more and more of, you know, boy meets girl, girl moves in with boy, girl keeps her rent-controlled apartment in Haight-Ashbury and turns it into an Airbnb rental. Now, the problem with that is that's an apartment that would otherwise go back on the market to be available as full-time renting for somebody in a city where housing is very scarce.
But suddenly she's an outlaw subletter, and housing becomes just a little bit tighter in San Francisco at that moment.
Exactly. So, and that's really the big issue that housing activists have with it. So that and the idea that landlords themselves see the opportunity to make more money renting on Airbnb. You know, if you can charge $200 a night in Airbnb, that's $6,000 a month. Maybe on the open market, you'd rent that same apartment for $3,000 a month. So it's more lucrative for landlords, and also they get to skirt rent control. Our city attorney has actually filed some lawsuits against some landlords who turned apartments into full-time Airbnb rentals.
All kinds of kerfuffle around Airbnb and its cousins. Joy in Worcester, Massachusetts. Joy, you're on the air. What's your experience?
I've got a great experience using all sorts of different rental companies, from HomeAway to companies like that, both for business, both for companies local here in the Massachusetts area, and getting, you know, under market pricing. So, benefit you were talking about earlier with for the Google employees, as well as personal use. I'm originally from New York, and I consider myself a city person. And what I love to do, going back into cities like New York and go visit Chicago or San Francisco, is picking a neighborhood that maybe I never lived in, and then, you know, renting there. What I think works in this sharing environment also is, even when you're on your own, when an owner is not around, because we have electronics with us constantly, our iPads, our iPhones, other devices, you can use other technology, OpenTable, OpenStream, to find what you're looking for. Okay, I'm here in the middle of Soho. Where's the nearest Starbucks? Where's the nearest Indian restaurant?
Yeah.
You don't necessarily need that concierge any longer.
Joy, I really appreciate your call. Pauline Frommer, does that give you cold sweats? I mean, after all, you're the famous guidebook family. And now here's Joy. She has her smartphone and all the information on there, and she can learn whatever she wants to in a few minutes in whatever neighborhood she's in about what her options are.
Well, I hope she's using her smartphone to go to Frommers.com. I mean, we're not just paper anymore. We're also electronic. So it doesn't give me cold sweats at all. It's just the way of the future.
Yeah, good. But it does seem like that is, in a way, part and parcel of opening up communities in this way. People have digital access to information, even if they're not on the tourist trail, even if they're in a whole new neighborhood.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you have that whether you stay in a hotel or in a private apartment. I mean, this is a very old concept, B&Bs. You have them all over the world. They had become professionalized, but they started just like this new wave is starting, of people needing to make ends meet and taking in boarders. Yes, sometimes it's greedy landlords, and it has affected the housing stock in some cities. But for the most part, it seems to me like a people-to-people sharing movement.
Carolyn, do you think it's changing the visitors' experience of San Francisco in a significant way, or is it just a bed and then they're back out in the same, streets as everybody else?
I do think visitors who stay in Airbnbs, as Pauline mentioned, they tend to no longer just be clustered in the downtown or the tourist areas. The Airbnbs are spread out throughout the city. Our study showed they're, you know, widely dispersed throughout the city, with a heavy concentration, for instance, in the Mission, which is a trendy neighborhood that has very few hotels, and, you know, lots in residential areas, which makes sense because they are in residences. So those tourists do get a different experience, and they are happy. You know, they get to feel like they are participating in the daily life of the city. They're not just there as a tourist. They get to experience a little taste of what it feels like to actually live in the city. I myself, for many years, have traveled with Servas, which is an volunteer organization where you can, and other organizations where you can. I've rented apartments not through Airbnb, just for years, just because I've liked that same experience myself. And as Pauline said, this is not really a new concept, but what Airbnb has done is it's turned it into a massive, massive movement by creating this centralized market that has about something like 600,000 listings on it now, and by creating a way to process transactions, by creating the review system for people to feel secure with who they're renting with.
Carolyn Saeed, a business reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks so much for the report on your town, Carolyn.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about summer vacations, vacationing in the age of Airbnb and its many cousins, travel and vacationing in the sharing economy. Pauline Frommer is with us from New York, editorial director for the Frommer Guidebooks. As she said, buy them in a book or read them online. She's happy either way. Before this hour's over, we'll look a little bit at Uber, which has its cars out there challenging the taxi industry and how all that is rolling out. Pulling all kinds of response here. Jason in Ashland, Oregon says, Ashland now has a law that does not allow vacation rentals by owner stays under a month. Oregon Shakespeare Festival, Jason writes to us, is huge money out here. And the hotel and B&B lobby got this legislation passed. Jason says, why can't I stay where I want? Why can't I rent out my house as long as I want? Those businesses sticking to the old non-tech business model don't know how to compete in this new age of the sharing economy. Hold that thought. We're going to go to Madison, Wisconsin in just a moment. But first, a call from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think you guys have talked quite a bit about the East Coast and the West Coast and big cities, and one area that's not really been discussed is the advantage of Airbnbs throughout the Midwest along the interstate. And as a host, I can offer a very unique experience. I'm 100% eco-friendly. I don't use harmful chemicals in my house. My sheets aren't scratchy like they might be at some hotels.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of benefits. And whenever the health department is brought up to me, I can tell you that my house is way cleaner than the majority of hotel rooms I've ever stayed in.
Bravo for you. So you're doing it, Mary. And how often do you have guests? And what's the experience like for you, for them?
In the summertime, I usually have, I would say, 3 to 4 per month. Sometimes for a day, sometimes for a whole week. I have some guests coming up in August that will be here for 2 weeks. So it's a nice extra source of income for me, just like it would be for somebody in the cities. But like I said, the advantage for the traveler is that it's a unique experience, and you can get some of the things you wouldn't be able to get from a hotel. The other thing I wanted to bring up was the big advantage for me is that I thought about starting a bed and breakfast.
Yeah.
But with Airbnb, I can screen these people, and I do. I make sure that there isn't any little red flags that tell me that this person might be, you know, dangerous, or that they, you know, they have to be verified.
Yeah.
And I wait for other people to review them.
What about your that's cool. What about your neighbors in your town, Mary? What do they think of your side business?
I am outside of town, and I really hope that my neighbors don't find out, because I know another, I stayed with a gal in Des Moines, Iowa, and when her neighbors found out, she actually had to go legitimate as a bed and breakfast. I'm fairly rural, so I'm hoping that I could stay on the down low, but yeah, you know, that doesn't last forever. But
oh, Mary, I appreciate your call very much, and good luck with it. Pauline, it's so interesting, this outlaw on the down low economy that's emerging here on vacationing, of all things.
Well, in a lot of places, this is perfectly legal. I mean, maybe it's not legal in Des Moines, but on her stretch of highway that she's off of, it could be legal. Maybe it's because she's not paying taxes. And that's an issue that I do think Airbnb should be addressing, because that's something that affects us all.
Hotels are chipping in to keep everything running, and maybe at some point they need to as well. Let's go to a town where I think that's the way it's working. Madison, Wisconsin. Deb Archer is with us. She's president and CEO of the Greater Madison Convention and Visitors Bureau. Deb, thanks very much for joining us for a minute today.
Well, thanks for having me.
I spent a very, very happy college summer in Madison. Wonderful, wonderful town. What's your experience with the sharing economy and accommodations, Deb? How are you handling it?
Well, you can imagine in a college town that the sharing economy certainly has caught on a while ago. And we're talking about Airbnb. That's sort of a phenomenon that we saw coming down the tracks a couple of years ago. And our city wisely, I think, thought, let's get ahead of the curve and see how we can address this.
How did you do that? What did you do?
Well, what was important was, first of all, we're a very very participatory community, and so the city opened up conversations with our lodging community, neighborhoods, zoning people, public officials, so we could really ground ourselves in a conversation about what makes sense. Can we create a framework for this new accommodation option without cannibalizing businesses that, you know, invested a lot of money, hotels, B&Bs, other businesses that are, you know, official business options for accommodations.
So you've required people doing this now to be licensed and to pay room taxes in Madison, is that right?
That's correct. That we tried to create a framework addressing city ordinances in which city businesses would have to comply. So it doesn't necessarily reflect state regulations, but what the city ordinances would comply to create equal footing with the other accommodations businesses. And what, so, yes, business what, licensing and collecting room tax.
What's been the impact of that on Airbnb activity in Madison? Is it equal to what it might be if you didn't have those regulations? Has it been stifled, or it seems to be very active anyway?
Well, we haven't done an assessment, an inventory, I should say, of Airbnb since the ordinance was passed. We do know that there have been some B&Bs who've actually called and now want to become members of our Convention and Visitors Bureaus, as well as calling and asking questions about what do we do for licensing, how do we collect room tax. So I think it's created an awareness that there is a practical reason why these ordinances are in place, and hopefully in Madison, the people that are engaging in this business really recognize this is really for the safety and welfare of the visitors to have their businesses now be licensed, as well as the fairness and also the contribution to our city economy by collecting the room tax. And I think the Airbnb people in Madison have been very mindful of why these ordinances have been put in place.
Pauline, what do you think? Are you going to have towns envying Madison here, or worried that if they do that, they'll shut off the full flow of potential visitors?
I think that most towns are going to be happy to get the income from taxes, and we'll see the validity of regulating this. I think that that's seems pretty standard, and I think that's the way this is all moving. I've actually paid room tax on certain our Airbnb stays that I've done, so it's not unheard of, and I think it's a great idea.
Let's go to Peter in Oklahoma City. Peter, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Peter Kazora from Oklahoma City. Thanks for having me.
Sure. What's your experience?
Well, I'd actually like to bring up a topic. I was listening to the program, and it sounds an awful lot like a program I was a part of called Couch Surfing. And what that is it's a very similar where guests and travelers join a social site, a community site, and what they do is they allow travelers and people from out of town to come and stay with them for an extended period of time or even a night or two while traveling in their home. And there's no money involved whatsoever. It's predominantly just opening up your place to a traveler, and usually people bring either food or some drink or some wine or some beer, and they'll stay with you, and you post up on your site, on your profile, what kind of accommodations you have, whether you're pet-friendly, smoking-friendly, yep, how many people you can accommodate, and then people will send you a message and a request saying, I'd like to come and stay with you from the 21st to the 23rd. Would that be okay? And can you message me back?
A bottle of wine, a loaf of bread, and thee. It sounds like wonderful. Talk about that really is sharing there, Peter. And have you done it? Have you enjoyed it?
I have. I've been doing it for about 8 years now. And initially I started in New York. I actually did some schooling down in the Caribbean. And then we moved upstate to Albany, New York. And now we're out in Oklahoma City. And I've had couch surfers both ways. I've stayed with friends and with people in Montreal. I've had people stay with me here in Oklahoma just recently. A couple driving across the country needed a place to stay, and they come and stay with you. And if they want to hang out in the living room and have some wine and some conversations and share stories, it's great. And if they say, hey, we're in the mood to go out, you can show them local culture and what your city has to offer and kind of pay it back and pay it forward as you travel along as well.
Peter, it sounds like a lot of fun, and I appreciate your call on that front. Pauline, what do you think? Are we headed into a new culture here, an old culture here? Limits to how much people are going to want to participate in the sharing economy? That's pretty open door practically right there.
Yeah, it's very open door. It's all different because it's through the internet, but there have been cultures and traditions of hospitality for years. Mm-hmm. You know, this is nothing new. I have a friend who's a harpist, and she was in the national tour of South Pacific for 10 months. She couch surfed. She didn't pay a cent for housing across the United States. She thinks she saved $40,000.
Of course, not everyone can pull out their harp and enchant the household for the evening.
Right.
But maybe we all have stories to tell, something to share right there.
Well, and it's a way for hosts to bring travel into their daily lives by welcoming travelers. It makes their lives more exciting.
Different cultures, different people, and different experiences. Changing world of summer vacation. Some of it not so changed, and at other ends, we're hearing it right here, changing a lot, maybe going back to the future. It's been great to talk with both of you. Deb Archer, President and CEO of the Greater Madison Convention and Visitors Bureau in Madison, Wisconsin. Deb, thanks for joining us for a few minutes. Really appreciate it.
You are so welcome.
And Pauline Frommer, it's always great to talk with you, Editorial Director at the Frommer Guidebooks, joining us today from New York. Pauline, good luck with all your work. Happy travels out there. Keep us clued in, Pauline.
Happy trails to you.
Thanks very much. I want to turn from accommodations to getting around. And the whole story of Uber and others, Lyft and more, have been challenging the traditional taxi industry with their service. Dial them up, they come to where you are, agree on a price, and off you go. Emily Badger joins us right now from Washington, staff writer who covers urban policy for the Washington Post's Wonk blog. Emily Badger, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So how's it going for Uber and Lyft and their cousins? Are they winning the day, or are they being battled out of town by the taxi business?
Well, they face a very similar situation to Airbnb in that with transportation a lot like tourism, these are issues that are not regulated in Washington. They're not regulated by the federal government. They're regulated by cities and city councils, by public utility commissions, by state houses. And so Uber and Lyft are dealing with different environments all over the country. In Seattle, they've just established some new regulation. In California, the Public Utilities Commission there has regulated these things. On the other hand, we have cities like Pittsburgh and Miami-Dade County that are impounding cars that are illegally providing these services. So they've entered into a market where this activity is very ambiguous as to whether or not it's legal, and cities are responding to that in some very different ways, just depending on whether or not people think this is a good thing or not, and there's a lot of debate about that.
Impounding the car, that's getting pretty serious. For people who have not used it, describe exactly how these services work.
Well, Uber offers a couple of different services. One of them is this sort of semi-traditional black town car service, which is not terribly controversial. The thing that Uber does, and this is also the service that Lyft provides that's really causing a lot of challenges, is they're saying anyone with a private car and a driver's license can give rides to people, can basically sort of function like a driver for hire. And this sort of fundamentally changes how cities have regulated transportation, because so often we're talking about cab drivers who have chauffeur's licenses, driving cabs that have been, you know, given 21-point inspections, driven by cab drivers who've taken 3 or 4 day-long classes to learn how to navigate the city. You know, when we're talking about just me and my Prius giving rides to people, now that sort of fundamentally changes the entire ballgame, because now we're opening up the idea of rides for hire to just about anybody. And that's sort of fundamentally challenges how cities have thought about transportation and how they've regulated it in the past.
And describe exactly how that works. You're tooling around in your Prius. I'm somewhere and need a ride. How do we connect and how do we make the deal?
Well, everything is done through a smartphone app. I mean, this is the sort of innovation that's allowed this to be possible, something that wasn't possible 5 or even 10 years ago. So if I want a ride, I pull up the Uber app on my phone. I sort of drop a pin with a GPS point saying, you know, I'm standing at this corner in Washington, D.C. I would like a ride. And then people who are driving around in the area will see that I'm standing here. Someone will respond and say, yes, I'll come pick you up. And then after that person accepts the ride, I can literally watch on a little map on my phone as the car approaches where I am waiting. And then I hop in the car, and the driver and I never exchange any money, because one of the things that Uber does is it sort of tethers your credit card to your account through the app. And this is part of what's so appealing about this service, particularly to a lot of young consumers. You never have to worry about whether or not a cab driver is going to say, I don't take credit cards, or whether or not you have the right amount of cash. I mean, the entire transaction is just so seamless. months, from the moment that you request a cab to the moment it shows up to the moment you get out of it and pay for it. And that's the kind of convenience that's really set Uber apart from traditional cabs. It's made it so appealing to a lot of consumers, even as it's made it kind of maddening to regulators.
How do you agree on a price for this trip that you're giving me?
So Uber and Lyft does this also. They calculate the price in a very similar way to a taxi meter, although there isn't literally a taxi meter in the car, obviously. Uber is calculating it based on sort of the GPS tracking of the vehicle tells you sort of how far you've gone, how much time has elapsed, and Uber makes that calculation. So I don't get in the car and say, you know, I would like to go to this corner, I will pay you $5 for it. That amount of money is determined by Uber and then automatically paid off of my credit card, and although I would have a chance to leave a tip off of it. But this is one of the reasons why cabs are so upset about this service. They're saying what you're doing looks exactly like cab service, and you're even calculating the fares in a way that looks a lot like cab service.
I'm looking at one of your recent headlines, Emily. It says, investors think Uber is worth $17 billion. Why that's not entirely crazy? Explain.
Well, this is sort of the big news out of the sharing economy last month, was that Uber raised a bunch more money that at a rate that valued the company at $17 billion. Add the money that they just raised, and now we're talking about a company that's valued at about $18.5 billion, which is just an astronomical amount of money, not just for the sharing economy, but specifically for all Silicon Valley startups. I mean, this is just a tremendous amount of money. And I think what a lot of people are anticipating is that, you know, Uber right now is a company that provides transportation services, but there are a lot of signs that Uber has aspirations to expand beyond giving people rides. They've already begun experimenting with services in New York City that are more like package delivery, that are more like logistics. And I think what we're going to see in the long run from this company is that, you know, yes, it will provide something that looks like taxi service, but it will also probably provide a lot of other services as well that take advantage of the fact that Uber is fundamentally, at the end of the day, a data company. I mean, they're just producing vast amounts of data on where vehicles move, what people want to have transported, where they want it to be transported. And they could really kind of build a logistics empire off of all of that software that does so much more than just give people taxi-like rides.
World just keeps changing. Emily Badger, you're just terrific. Thank you very much for looking at Uber and Lyft and all the rest with us for a minute today. Thanks for joining us, Emily.
Thanks, Tom.
Emily Badger covers urban policy for the Washington Post's Wonk blog. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.